covered with black hair, but it was useful materials. There was a soldier stationed nearby with a spear, dispatching the wounded goblins entangled in the mess, and watching for surprises. "Sergeant! Over here!" I shouted to the militiaman in charge of the salvage operation. "I need 2 more horses and 6 men. Shift this beam here," I pointed, and for the next 10 minutes we disassembled one edge of the pile, searching by sight and by magic. At last I came to the shattered wand of a dead shaman, on which was a single green stone. Placing it into a specially prepared pouch, we thanked the men and rode on to the next one. We recovered 6 of the 7 witch stones, but we took some losses, too. The last shaman had speared one of the black flag, and escaped with his life and his stone on the man's horse. The others were dead or soon to be, and this pretty harvest made it all worthwhile. By the time we had finished finding the 7th stone, it was growing darker. Our mage lights had long since died out, and the screen of horsemen was beginning a measured retreat back to the castle. The defiant and outraged screams of the goblins could be heard just beyond the forest line, where they prepared a counter-charge. We had no intention of being there when that happened. We grabbed what we could off the field and headed back behind stone walls for the evening. By the time the sun fell behind the western horizon, the great gates of the castle were closed. The inner bailey was heaped with unsorted loot, lumber, iron, even leather and cloth, and some of the more edible foodstuffs we'd recovered. The civilians were climbing over the piles and cheering, save those who were tending the wounded in the field hospital Sire Kusi had erected near the front gate in preparation. Of those, there were many. They cheered me and Tyndall and my magical corps, even Garkescu, when we entered the bailey. I wish I felt like cheering. As I came through, a messenger headed for Sire Kusi's study told me the score of the battle. We lost nearly 120 men in the attack outright, and almost twice that number had been wounded. That was light compared to the blood of no less than 5,000 goblins that stained the field. But the towers had fallen, and we had bought ourselves a little more time. When I finally climbed the stairs to my quarters, I noticed Tyndall saying he wanted to continue celebrating in the bailey. I should have suspected something was afoot then, as he said this through a yawn, but I was so tired myself that I nodded blearily and continued my stumble. As I shed my clothes by candlelight, I was too tired to use a mage light, I noticed a dark shape in my hammock. It leaned forward, and as a cascade of honey-blonde hair fell away from her face and spilled over her bare breasts, I recognized the face of the pretty widow, Alia.
"Your apprentice said you had an eye for me," she said in a sultry voice. "I feel it is my duty to show you how appreciative we are for your efforts."
I studied the curve of her throat and the shadows that the candle cast in the valley between her magnificent breasts. Despite my sorely used body, I had the usual reaction. Suddenly, I felt superhuman. "Well," I said slowly, "I guess it would be rude for me to refuse an earnest demonstration of appreciation." Damn Tyndall. Chapter 9. Uruk's Rebellion. I didn't leave my room for 2 days. Tyndall kept us fed, at least I think it was Tyndall. Every 6 hours or so, someone would leave a basket full of food in front of the door. But it could have been the damned Gavani for all I knew. I didn't see the boy once for 2 straight sunsets. The respite with Alia was that enjoyable, and the cold autumn rains encouraged me to stay indoors. I just couldn't think of any place else I'd rather be than in that hammock in her arms. Alia was the tonic my tired soul needed. She wasn't complicated, like Pentandra, and she wasn't opportunistic like, well, like most of the other girls I'd bedded. She seemed genuinely happy to be with me, and I found that intensely flattering. On the morning of the 3rd day, I rolled over in the hammock, a feat which takes practice, and noticed that Alia was gone, and I tensed. Then I smelled frying bacon, and I relaxed. Soon the scents of fresh brewed tea and toasting bread joined it, and I allowed my eyelids to gradually lift themselves. I was rewarded with the sight of a naked Alia tending the small brazier Tyndall and I used to cook upon. Well, mostly Tyndall. That's the whole point of having an apprentice. Cheap labor. The light from the arrow slits told me it was mid-morning and not raining for a change. Then it did double duty by bathing her in one of those golden glows that you tend to associate with otherworldly creatures. She didn't realize I was awake, and I admit that I watched her with great interest as she went about the business of cooking breakfast. Naked. Alio was a real find. She was utterly beautiful, in a distinctive, peasanty sort of way. Her facial features were bold and pronounced. Her eyes were the brightest shade of blue-gray I'd ever seen. Her hair was a field of ripe, wild grains. She had the bearing of a queen and the body of a healthy, lusty peasant maiden. Her feet were a little big, which I had noted to our mutual amusement the previous evening. I didn't mind. They matched. We had talked incessantly when we weren't otherwise occupied, and I had learned a lot more about her than I had at our earlier encounter. The middle daughter of Goodman Rorrell, a prosperous freeholding farmer and herder of some repute at the hillside farm known as Hawk's Reach. She had taken charge in the cheese sheds for the last year, after returning home to try to forget her grief, and while the memory of her young husband still burned in her heart, she at last had started to entertain the idea of love again, when the Gervani invasion interrupted her courting prospects. I had made quite an impression on her, apparently, though she didn't think I was interested in a serious relationship or expected anything more than a quick tumble. I didn't admit that I was, but then I didn't say that I wasn't. I was still getting to know her. I was glad that she had made it to the fortress before the gates had shut. Her sister and brother-in-law Sargal were also here, out in the bailey, but it was her I wanted to see. Alia had seen me around the castle several times since she and her family had arrived, but didn't want to disturb me. She still thought I was handsome and charismatic, and she knew I was brave and resourceful. Her brother-in-law was doing very well now. But she didn't want to intrude, or presume an affection that might not be returned. She told me that I was comely enough that she expected a long line of lusty maidens awaited me at my door every night. I found that hard to believe. While I am not as ugly as Furtak, I'm no handsome prince. After our fourth or fifth bout, she admitted coyly that she had been drawn to me since we first met, and even admitted feeling eyes on her that day when I saw her from the tower, though she could have been exaggerating. But my apprentice was aware of my interest. Tyndall had approached her in that lanky, too shy way of his, and asked if she was spoken for yet. He then mentioned that his lord had expressed an interest in her, and asked if she would be willing to meet with me again to pass the time, and fight the boredom implicit in castle life. She was agreeable, and my tower room was dry and heated, compared to her small allotment of space in the bailey. I enjoyed just being with her. Alia was smart, as well as beautiful. She had increased profits at her father's farm while she had been in charge of the cheese shed. She could read, at least some, which is rare in a woman in Beauval Vale, or a man for that matter. Indeed, she had actually read 5 or 6 books, which made her a scholar by local standards. She had an abiding curiosity about the world and a quick and sharp wit. Best yet, she had over a year of repressed tensions to work out. All in all, a wonderful companion during this time of stress and crisis. In my mind, her wholesome, noble image crumbled a bit when a strip of bacon popped over the coals, sending a drop of hot grease to splatter on her left breast. She shrieked and dropped the bread she was buttering, butter side down, of course, and rubbed her burned breast while she made a face.
"Is she's tits?"
she yelped, as she rubbed at the burn. The bacon grease instantly transformed her from the well-behaved woman back into a fussy peasant housewife. I couldn't help but chuckle, which startled her again.
"You're awake."
"Never fry bacon naked," I admonished her, "or didn't your mother ever teach you that?"
"It was never an issue at our house, but I'll keep it in mind. It's about time you woke up."
I swung my feet over the side of the hammock and stood, realizing that I was naked too, then smiled when I recalled why. I quickly crossed the cold stone floor and bent to kiss her bacon-flavored wound. Reaching out with my mind, I repaired the tiny burn without even tapping into the power of the witch stones. At least the blemish was gone and wouldn't chafe against her clothes, if she ever wore any again. The effect tingles, and it had a predictable effect on her nipple.
"Boo-boo is all better now," I said, grinning. "Damn, it really is. That's great. You know, you're a handy one to have around."
"Let me show you just how handy."
"After breakfast, you tireless lech. I'm starved."
She handed me a toasted trencher with bacon, fried eggs, and a thick wedge of cheese on it. I paid her a kiss in return and sat down at the small table, which I noticed she had cleared of all the debris that two bachelors can accumulate in a few weeks. That was the first unmistakable sign, I realized, that I suddenly had a girlfriend. Surprisingly, even with the prospect of death and doom just outside the castle wall, the thought pleased me. Alia joined me a moment later with her own trencher, still naked, and handed me a mug of strong country tea as she sat. Breakfast was excellent, as good or better as I could have done on my own, and the company was certainly engaging. We chatted lightly about nothing in particular for a long while. As I finished the meal, however, the way her tousled dark blonde tresses spilled over her chest, just managing to cover her nipples, started to get to me. I approached her with all the subtlety of a Randy dragon and pulled her into my lap. Only a knock at the door spared her from a thorough post-breakfast ravishing. I groaned and let her free. She giggled guiltily and tried to throw her shapeless chemise over her head in a token of modesty, while I reluctantly pulled on a more or less clean tunic from a press. After being naked for 2 days, wearing clothes was suddenly a novelty. It was Tyndall at the door. My apprentice stumbled into the room looking like a refugee and smelling like a beer barrel. The look in his slitted eyes was all too familiar. I had seen it in a mirror on many occasions.
"Good morning, master," he mumbled, as he slewed over to the stove and poured himself a scalding mug of tea. "Sleep well?"
I glanced at Alia, who had found a comb and was tugging her hair into shape. "Well enough. I'll have to find some way to thank you for such excellent service." Tyndall glanced up at Alia and smiled.
"I just thought that, you being so busy with the defense of the castle and all, that you would neglect to reintroduce yourself." "Tyndall, I hope that we didn't throw you out of your quarters,"
Alia asked, concerned. The boy shook his head, which he immediately regretted, and shot her a shy grin.
"You aren't the only lady of the castle who is grateful to the magical corps after the last battle. I did not lack for a comfortable bed. I just wish that I had declined that last mug of beer."
"Let me fix it," I said, grabbing the pouch with my sphere off the table. In seconds I had transformed the alcohol in his blood, although I could do little with the soured contents of his stomach or the pain in his head. Some things you should just have to suffer through. Besides, if they bothered him enough, he could manage the simple spell. Still, his eyes got wider and brighter, and became a less malevolent shade of red.
"Many thanks, master,"
he gasped gratefully as the spell subsided.
"I actually came here on an errand. Sarkusi has summoned you and Master Garkescu to the council room. All the officers shall be there. It is to be held at noon, which," he said, glancing out of an open arrow slit at the sun, "will be in about half an hour."
I grunted, disappointed that my lust would go unsated for a while longer. If the meeting was in the council room, instead of his study, that meant that this would be one of those huge councils that accomplished little. It would be long and boring and wouldn't be over with until every junior assistant captain of the trash disposal committee had had their say. At the least, it would kill the afternoon. I sighed and grabbed another piece of bread. I had better ideas for how to kill an afternoon. But duty calls.
"Very well, then. I guess I'll have to go.
Tyndall, if you would be so kind as to fill the copper tub with water and then heat it. With magic, mind, no fires. I will have a quick bath before I go."
"I heartily agree,"
Alia spoke up.
"You were starting to smell."
I gave her an indignant glance, reminding her silently of why I had worked up a sweat. "Just for that, wisecrack, you have to help bathe me." That would teach her. For 6 months after the last climactic battle of the Doge's Tower, I had the pleasure of being part of a conquering occupation force, with all the duties and privileges associated therewith. Mostly that meant loot, girls, guard duty, girls, drunken stupors, girls, reprisals against rebels, girls, indulgence in unimaginable luxury, girls, interrogation of prisoners, girls, bargain shopping, and girls. I even got a little sightseeing in. Faris was a very pretty city, even after we got through with it, and the people were nice, even after what we did to them. I liked the tropical climate and the exotic foods. I perfected my command of the imperial language of Lost Perwin, which the Farisi spoke in a debased form, with plenty of Cormeran influence. That was helped by liaisons with a number of local girls, whose dusky and exotic imperial appearance reminded me pleasantly of Penny. The Coronet Council installed Master Vanaren as the military commander of the city, a rare token of respect for the ducal magical corps. That raised a lot of objections from the regular nobility who'd had their eyes on that position. But the council was clear, and Master Vanaren was mostly above the politics that infected the occupation forces. In return for our service in the battle, he made the quartering and boarding of the magical corps a top priority. After we won the war, there was a bumper crop of widows and maidens around, not to mention slaves, whose masters had been killed in defense of the town. And apart from some initial resistance, the victory was not marred by strife. The Farisi seemed content to be ruled from afar, again, after the mess the Doge had made of the city. It helped that Master Vanaren was not a punitive man, compared to the barons and counts in the occupying army. He kept order in the streets, making Faris a comparatively civilized occupation. But he didn't discourage fraternization, and I took full advantage of it. Had I not been careful to do the proper spells, likely I'd have a dozen half-dusky bastards crawling in that exotic port city by now. But after 6 months, even cushy garrison duty gets old, and without significant opposition to our rule, there was little reason to keep a fully staffed magical corps on hand. About the time we started growing restless, we began receiving orders to return to the duchies and be discharged from service. I was a little shocked. I had grown used to the soldier's life. Mustering out seemed to panic me. I would need a job, after all. My return to civilian life put me right back where I had been on graduation day. Well, not quite. I had a pile of loot, and a generous big payoff in specie for my service, more than my father made in profit at his bakery in 10 years. One of the reasons the Magical Corps was the first unit to be discharged, I've heard, is that we were comparatively expensive to keep. Infantry are cheap. Cavalry, apart from knights acting as officers, of little use to the occupation, so my fellows and I were taking up a large part of the budget. Once the overt magical threat was gone, regular infantry could be used to pacify rebels instead of us. So we were paid off and shipped out as fast as the clerks could write the orders. After that, I had enough treasure for a real stake, capital I could use to pursue just about anything I wanted to do. I just needed to figure out what to do. On the stormy, rat-infested trip back to the duchies, I thought long and hard about my future. I had made up my mind to return to Talry, visit my folks, and maybe look around for a court job, when a baron from the Geerum Hills, who was also heading back, offered me a handsome sum to help him attack his neighbor's castle, seeing as how the man was still on duty in Faris. He was willing to pay a premium price for veterans in the surprise campaign. Geerum was on my way, so a small digression was not troubling. While I questioned his ethics, I welcomed his gold. When he stood triumphant on the donjon of his hereditary enemy's stronghold 4 weeks later, I decided to go back to Talry and visit my folks. On my way out of the keep, a mule bearing my treasure at my side, a fellow war mage mentioned a knight banneret, who was involved in a boundary dispute with his cousin in the coastlands, and was looking for military help resolving the issue. After that, it was a knight who wanted assistance settling an inheritance dispute, and after that, a year and a half later, I had 4 mules to tote my treasure, an account with the Temple of Ifnia, and a growing reputation as a reliable mercenary war mage. Oh, I tried my hand at regular magic between military gigs. I worked with a few spellmongers, studied a few weeks with this court mage or that, but the lure of quick gold for doing a simple, if dirty job, was just too potent to ignore. My reputation was growing. My financial reserves were growing. My skills at war magic were growing. I also felt a growing dissatisfaction with my lifestyle. The problem was simple. I didn't like violence, but I was very good at it. I was right about the War Council meeting on all accounts. It was an obvious opportunity for propaganda, designed to congratulate ourselves for the accomplishment of still being alive. I couldn't argue with Kusi's logic. We needed all the morale we could muster. First, the old knight, sitting on a chair that was one point away from being a throne, gave a long, solemn speech about his brave ancestors' first coming to this land, their cunning defeat of the Gavani, their effort to build a peaceful and prosperous domain in this fertile valley, etc., etc. Having whetted his lance outside of the castle walls, Kusi looked a little less like a condemned man today, and a little more like the leader he was. He was hopeful. Someone had found a clean surcoat for him, and someone else had shaved his cheeks and brushed his hair. His sword was laying across his knees, and in one hand he held his mace of office, a little ceremonial club given to him by his baronial liege as a symbol of his dominion in the domain. He seemed upbeat and positive, which was a welcomed change from the gloomy melancholia he'd started to sink into. The other members of the council assembled around him included the castle's officers, the leaders of his fighting men, and the elected representatives of the peasants of the Outer Bailey. Sire Kusi singled me and my magical corps out for special praise, thanks to our creative spellcasting. But the cavalry still got the most glory, as befitted their station. We all cheered at the appropriate times during the speech, and I tapped into the power of the Irionite to make the cheers seem louder than they actually were. It amused me. When Sire Kusi was finished with his speech, he turned the meeting over to a succession of officers for reports. Quartermaster, stores, physicians, and pretty much anyone who had a title and wanted to brag about how well they were doing. Then the war leaders had their turn recounting the recent battle in glowing, if not legendary, terms. When they were done, Sire Kusi finally asked for a report from the magical corps, and Garkescu and I stood up at the same time. I gave him a glance. I didn't mean for it to be threatening, and he sat down again. My lords and goodmen, the magical corps can report that the counterattack 3 days ago was an utter and absolute success. Due to proper planning and execution, the enemy's means of breaching our defenses were taken from the field. Significant casualties were inflicted, and the corps captured several items which will greatly aid in our future defense.
Sir Kusi, my lords, if I may,
Garkescu interrupted, standing again. I felt like glaring at him that time, but I was kind of curious as to what he would say. Reluctantly, I bowed and let him take the floor.
My good lord, while I have every confidence in Master Menelan's ability to direct our magical defense, he is a trained war mage, after all, and we are all damned lucky to have him here. I feel bound to inquire as to the disposition of the magical items he mentioned in his report. I would not endeavor to bore a layman with the specifics of it, but while I do not question Minolan's ability or genius at the arts of war, I do wonder if he has disposed of the booty of the counterattack to exploit its maximum effectiveness. Elder and wiser heads, with more experience in such matters, may be better suited to use them better.
I blinked. He wanted the witch stones.
I think it would be more appropriate, he continued, to distribute this new bounty of arcane artifacts. Trigg forbid that anything dire happen to our leader, but it seems foolish to conserve such power in one pair of hands in such a dire situation.
He was trying, without using spellcraft, just the practiced voice he used on clients in his shop, to sound both apologetic for questioning my command and righteously indignant about not getting the stones. He made my decision a matter of castle security.
I feel it is in the domain's best interests that Master Minolan should consider how best to distribute these powerful assets among our corps, and not keep them tucked away for protracted study.
He looked at me with raised eyebrows, as innocent as a child. I think the bastard had lined his beard again, too. While he was droning on, I thought about the matter for a moment, and was forced to concede that Calchescu had a point. I had 8 stones in my possession after the battle, and now that they had been in contact with my sphere, they were safe from Gervani influence. I was still getting accustomed to the power available from 1 stone. It was a heady feeling to use such forces, and it was getting easier, but I was far from plumbing the limits of its power. But I did know that trying to use all of them at once would likely burn out my brain. Nor was there any good reason to keep the others from using their vast potential in our defense, after being carefully instructed in their use. I could fall off a battlement any time, after all. And in my absence, the rest of the magical core, and likely the entire castle, would be screwed if no one else knew how to use them. I shrugged and did something Garki clearly hadn't expected. I agreed with him. I don't see why not. Have the magical core convene on the roof of the tower 2 hours before dusk, and I will distribute a witch stone to each of you. He bowed to me graciously, and the meeting continued without further acrimony, even though I was upset about the demand. I sat back down and endured another 12 reports on how successful the fire prevention effort has been, the anti-vermin program, and the distribution of rations, while I brooded over Garki's sense of entitlement. It didn't get interesting until it was time for Acting Petty Captain Goodman Loas to report. Loas was a big man, barrel-chested and broad-shouldered, a well-respected farmer in the Himmis district. He was kind of an aberration in Beauval Vale, in that he raised mostly sheep as opposed to cows, but no one argued with his knowledge of husbandry for either beast. He was regularly consulted for his expertise by everyone in the Vale. He had a prosperous holding, a large family, and brothers and brothers-in-law who would follow him in peace or war. In a more prosperous, more civilized domain, he would have been named a yeoman. His military career was less practiced. He had been elected captain of a few dozen men who made up the militia companies from Winnicar, and had led his men bravely in their limited capacity. I had heard that he had kept the band of Gervani from hitting the cavalry's flanks on the battlefield, so even the gentlemen knights listened when he spoke.
Sire Cusi, gentlemen, my fellow goodmen, my company performed as well as can be expected. We attacked the foe as ordered and lost only one man, old Banner, who had his neck broken by one of those foul beasties. My son Warren lost a little finger that he'll miss. There were no more serious casualties, thanks to Trigg's grace. But that's neither here nor there. What I want to ask you, Sire Cusi, is just what are we doing?
The old knight was startled, and cleared his throat before he spoke.
Can you be clearer, good man? We are defending ourselves against a vicious invader. I would think that would be obvious. Or perhaps I have misunderstood your question.
Loas leaned on the spear he carried like it was his more accustomed shepherd's staff, and spoke like he was talking about the weather with a neighbor at market, instead of an official military officer contending with his liege during a time of emergency. In a more civilized domain, he might have been dragged away and hanged for his insolence and temerity to his sworn lord in a time of war. Things are a bit looser in Beauval Vale, however. Arbitrary punishments were frowned upon, and the lack of serfs or bondsmen permits plain language that is frowned upon in larger domains. As he glanced around the hall, the crowd looked back at him like he and Cusi were debating in a pub, not as if a commoner had been insolent to his lord.
Sire, I know what we're doing. I'm no simpleton. A month ago, I was worried about how many sheep the wolves would get this winter. Now I'm a soldier in a castle surrounded by enemies, with no help in sight. My poor friend Rollo has lost his entire family in a raid. My fields are in ruins, my home abandoned, and my sheep are destined for slaughter, not the clipping sheds.
Yet you yet live,
reminded Sir Kay sternly from Sire Cusi's side, thanks to your liege's foresight and preparation.
Not that I'm ungrateful, sire. I do yet live, and my family has lost a finger, is all. And we struck 'em a good one, we did. I killed 7 myself. Me who never struck a blow in anger in my life. But for what? We struck them hard, but they are still there, and more arrive every day. We can see that from the walls, my lord. Are we to be rescued? Will the Baron send troops? Will Duke Lenguin? Enough to stop that whopping big army of goblins out there? And what if he does? He can drive those monsters back up into the mountains. But what's to stop them from returning? I can't tend to my stock when I'm worried the likes of them are lurking about, just waiting to brain me with one of their clubs. I love my lands, but my life is worth more to me.
Aye, shouted one of the other farmers-turned-militia. You sent word to Verone weeks ago. What of it? And what of the spellmonger? Can't he send for help with magic? When will it come?
A raucous murmur built up around the far end of the hall, where the peasants congregated. I watched Sire Cousy struggle to answer the uncomfortable questions, and I could see he was not up to it. He glanced at Sir Kay several times, but the castellan had no answer. The problem was that Loas, like Garkescu, had a very good and very valid point that made Sire Cousy as uncomfortable as I had been about the witchstones. He could count, as all shepherds can, and he knew roughly how many of the foe faced us. We were already badly outnumbered, and the goblins kept arriving at our doorstep like leaves in autumn. Even if every man in the Alshari Wilderlands took up arms and rode to Beauval's defence, it would be hard to drive back a tide that great. The aftermath of such a battle would leave the valley a scorched wasteland, and the prospect of eternal guerrilla raids on the farmsteads and crofts was all too real to Loas and the men he spoke for. So why were we holding out here, instead of making a dash for the passes and living to fight another day? I had been thinking the same thing lately. Currently, Beauval Castle was a lifeboat against the storm, a place of refuge against the onslaught of the Gavanni Horde. We could wait here safely for some time, thanks to our preparations. But what were we waiting for? Duke Lenguin would see the loss of Beauval a minor concession to the Gavanni that could be won back at a later date, after he properly prepared. But in a feudal society, that might take years, decades, lifetimes, particularly in the sparsely peopled wilderlands. The cavalry would not ride over the hill, swords flashing, any time that I could foresee. We could hold out for a good long time. But for what? The inevitable result would be the same. We'd just be starving when the end came, the longer we held out. That great green glow I had glimpsed in the west was coming toward us, a concentration of Irianite so large that the treefolk had warned of its potential to warp reality itself. A handful of knights, a castle full of peasants, and a couple of spellmongers would not keep it at bay, much less defeat it. That much was clear. It was becoming increasingly obvious that it wouldn't be a question of if we would be overwhelmed, but when. With winter approaching as well, the battlefield victory we'd managed would be a hollow memory in a few short weeks, as the Gavanni increased their strength enough to overwhelm us entirely. I watched Sire Cousy try to respond, his face twisted up in a mixture of anger and frustration. I knew an explosion of emotion would be bad for morale, so I intervened. "My lord, I would like to answer Petty Captain Loas, if I may," I said, bowing toward Sire Cousy. The old man looked relieved and anxious at the same time, but nodded permission for me to continue. "You are correct, Petty Captain, but you have confused the subjects of tactics and strategy. Our primary goal has been to persist in this place, which affords us good protection, and defend ourselves against the foe. That is a tactical problem. Where we go from here is a strategic question, and one that has been on all of our minds. Sire Cousy's most of all. But the tactical situation must be settled before we even know what our strategic options are." "What about you, spellmonger? Have you no spells to send for help?" I nodded solemnly. "Aye, and I have, and help may be on the way. Or it may not. I have not been able to penetrate the magical cloak that the Gavanni shamans have placed around the castle to find out. I say to you again, worry about keeping the goblins from our walls, and your lord will worry about our ultimate cause." Loas took a long moment before he sighed and nodded his head in agreement. Sire Kusi looked to me gratefully, and asked for the next report. It was a temporary fix to a serious problem, though, and we all knew it. Every day we were here, our odds at survival grew less. That was clear to us all. It would be against human nature to surrender to the inevitable, and rescue seemed a dim hope at best. Flight, at this stage, was nigh impossible, with the Moor Pass occupied, as well as most of the Vale beyond our walls. The more I thought about it, the more I was coming to the realization that we'd made a mistake by deciding to stay and fight against the goblins instead of fleeing. That would have at least preserved the lives of the people.
Damn it, Kusi, I thought to myself as we left the hall. Just what the hell are we doing here?
Gentlemen, I began later that evening on the top of the tower, as darkness began to fall. I want to remind you just what titanic forces you are about to encounter. In one moment, you will be as powerful as any mage since the fall of the Imperial Magocracy. You will be exposed to power you would otherwise never wield. I don't pretend to understand it, how it works, or what eventual dangers lay in its use, but I will give you this caution. Be careful with everything you do. A misstep could burn your brain to a cinder, or make you a hazard to everyone around you. The faces of Garkescu's apprentices were pale, and even their master looked shaken. Tyndall, standing at the end of the line, was trying to decide if he was more scared or more eager. Eager won out, as I knew it would. It's hard to describe to an outsider, but to a mage, this kind of power is more addictive than breathing. The desire to wield the power was palpable. I'd noticed it in myself, and made a point to keep an eye on it. I had the Arianite nuggets in a basket, each wrapped in an insulating layer of cloth. They had spent 2 full days in contact with my sphere, more than long enough to neutralize any hold the shamans might have had over them, but I hadn't wanted to take chances. I had struggled over which stone to give to which mage all afternoon. But I think I finally had decided. Each stone had a particular feel about it that is difficult to describe. I honestly didn't know if that feel made any difference or not, but my instinct told me to match the stone with the person. I haven't spoken much of Garkescu's apprentices up to now. For the longest time I had lumped them all together in my mind as mere appendages of their sleazy master. They weren't, of course. They had very separate and individual characteristics that I had just started to get to know. Eldest was Fenar, who was becoming a competent spellmonger in his own right. He was about 19, and he could have set up shop on his own had his master allowed it. Fenar didn't excel at any particular thing, unless you counted the snotty attitude his master had taught him. He was really good at that. Fenar was a bit of a bully, I guess. But in every craft, the senior apprentices have that kind of overbearing attitude toward their juniors. He was the son of a Himus fisherman, and he had the same flat-headed view of the world that his father had. He could have made a decent war mage with his temperament. I had selected a centimeter-wide, irregular shard for him that hummed with quiet but thickly available power. Fenar didn't need sophistication to complicate things for him. Garkescu's middle apprentice was around 15, a studious young lad named Rundal. He had been the product of a union between a castle servant and any one of a number of knights, men-at-arms, or passing travellers. He bore no stigma of his bastardy. The people of Beauval had pretty relaxed social standards about such things, and I know he held out the hope of the possibility of noble parentage in his mind. Rundal was a bright kid, a little nearsighted, and he excelled in alchemy, for which I envied him. I'd never done very well at the subject myself. He was smart and talented enough that I had toyed with the idea of sponsoring Rondal at the academy to fully develop his abilities, but I hadn't wanted to piss in Garkescu's front yard. He was still growing into his full adult shape, but he had a lot of promise. I had selected the largest chunk that was flat on one side for Rondal. It seethed with power, but had more focus than the other pieces. Lastly was Urik, a 12-year-old, whiny little snot who was chubby, bordering on fat, and a little more excitable than the others. He had an intermittent talent that seemed to favor telekinetic abilities. It might develop into something pretty impressive someday, but at 12, when your talent is first manifesting itself, It often appears sporadically. Some days it's almost overwhelming, and others it won't appear at all. That can be pretty frustrating for a mageling, and between that and the constant abuse from the two older apprentices and their pompous master, I couldn't really blame him for whining as much as he did. I had reserved the smallest piece for him. As I handed it to him, I stumbled briefly, realizing that I had just given a child a weapon more powerful than the mad mage had used against an army of magi. He accepted it eagerly. I hoped I knew what I was doing. For Garkescu, I had selected the largest piece. It was almost as big as my sphere, and I had picked it for him not only because of its size, but also because of its relatively low power. I don't know if there were impurities in the nugget, or if it had somehow lost a little of its magical efficacy, but I hoped that by limiting his access a bit, I might rein in his ego. He had a solemn look on his face, but there was a gleam in those eyes that made me uncomfortable. I tried to quell the doubt I felt about giving it to him. Desperate measures, for desperate times, I suppose. Tyndall had earned a special reward, I had decided, and so I had given him what was, to my mind, the most potent of the remaining stones. A cautious and good-hearted boy, while he was headstrong and impulsive, I still trusted him not to abuse the power I was giving him. He took the green amber as eagerly as the others. For a good 10 minutes they stood around and just stared at the Eirionite, exploring the arcane details of their stones with their minds. As they became acclimatized to them, with my encouragement and direction, they started experimenting with drawing forth power. We went through a number of basic drills to practice, and for an hour the tower top was filled with flames and lights and hovering stones and fanciful illusions. I'm sure it looked eerily spectacular from downstairs. Hopefully the arcane display would boost the castle's morale and lower that of the Gavani, whose large nocturnal patrols also witnessed the feats. It was on the Gavani that we next turned our attentions before retiring for the evening. I had each mage prepare and fire a magical bolt at the foe, who were easy to spot in mage sight. The patrols knew enough to keep out of bowshot, but the stones allowed magical attacks at a much greater range than even the great Wilderland's bows the archers employed. Once my magical corps saw how easy such a thing was, now that their natural talents were augmented, they spent several minutes gleefully showering magical death and mayhem on the patrols outside of the walls, until they sought cover. I doubt they killed more than a score of Gavani during the exercise, but I know it was both instructive and satisfying after the weeks of siege. Even Urik had no trouble conjuring an impressively potent blast. Indeed, he seemed better at it than the scholarly Rondal, which pleased the younger apprentice immensely. Eventually the harried patrols summoned a shaman, who put up decent enough defenses to make the impromptu assaults too difficult to be easy fun. Then the Gavani shaman sent a bolt back toward us. I easily blocked it, but it signaled an end to playtime. You all have been exposed to the power of Eirionite now. Keep your stones in their protective wrappings at night, and do not let anyone else handle them. Have a bite to eat and get some rest. These things will wear at you if you're not careful. Tomorrow we will use them to further strengthen our defenses. That's all, I said, and watched as the excited magical corps filed down the steps. Tyndall lingered, a fire in his eyes.
"Master," he began, "I had no idea how powerful the Eirionite makes you. I feel like I could kill every Gavani from here to the other side of the mountains, or fly through the air, or anything."
"Easy there, lad," I cautioned patiently. "It will take you months, if not years, to learn how to use it properly. Hells, I don't even know very much about them yet. Let's take it as slow, and explore their potency as the situation warrants."
"Master, I have a question," he asked thoughtfully. "With access to this kind of power, why haven't the Gavani leveled this castle by now? How could they not? If they have dozens of shamans using them, then what is preventing our fall? Other than your defense, that is," he added smoothly.
"Every apprentice learns how to suck up to his master, I suppose." I shrugged. "Actually, Tyndall, I've wondered about that myself of late. You're right. They should have overwhelmed us long ago. They waste their warriors on their attacks when it would be easy enough to blast their way in here, and it isn't my efforts that have stopped them. Oh, our defensive spells are adequate for most of the more subtle forms of attack, but they would do little against a dozen shamans making an all-out attack on us with their stones. The truth is, I have no idea. I sense that their siege is part of some larger plan.
Something to do with the... whatever it is that approaches us daily, he whispered.
Yes, I sighed. I'm afraid so. Our time is running out, and while tonight was fun, I honestly can't see any good way out of our situation. I'm beginning to regret that we stayed to fight.
I'm not,
Tyndall declared, holding up his stone to admire it.
I wouldn't have this beauty if that was the case, but I do hope we survive long enough for me to figure out how to use it properly.
If the exposure doesn't send you mad, I cautioned. Tyndall couldn't think of anything to say to that, and neither could I. As powerful as they were, we both knew that power was also very dangerous. We went downstairs and went to bed. Tomorrow would be a long day, and we had yet to realize just how right we were. Sometime long past midnight, I sat bolt upright in shock. If you ever try doing this in a hammock, you will discover that sitting bolt upright is not only difficult, but potentially disastrous. Having someone sharing your hammock while you do so is even less recommended. Alia looked at me angrily, having been rudely woken from a sound sleep and almost dumped on the floor.
Bad dream? Are you feeling randy again?
She asked, irritated, as she struggled to hang on to the sides of the hammock. I ignored her. There was trouble afoot. I could feel the vibrations throb through the tower like a low bass note. Someone was using a lot of magical power around us. It had to be an attack. The shamans had finally found a way past our defenses and gotten a strike force inside the castle itself, I reasoned. But the wards were still in place, I saw when I checked. That was even more confusing. I called to Tyndall, who was awake for the same reason I was. That reverberation of power couldn't be ignored by someone with even the smallest talent. He knew there was a problem too, but he didn't panic, as he had the first night of the invasion. With a nod, he flipped me my mage blade from where it had been hanging while drawing his own. I started for the stairs to the top of the tower.
Minolan!
Alia complained worriedly.
Where are you going?
We're under attack, I called back. Stay there until I come back for you. Her pretty eyes went wide and she shivered under the blanket. Tyndall was already starting up the ladder to the fighting deck at the top of the tower when we both realized that the emanations were coming from below, not above. Reversing course immediately, we spilled down the stairs into Garkescu's chambers, and into a scene out of one of the nine hells. Garkescu was smashed flat against a wall, struggling to move. There didn't seem to be anything holding him up, until you used mage sight. Rundal was floating ineffectually through the air, waving his arms in a manner that would have been hilarious under other circumstances. Fenar was writhing around on the floor, engulfed in bright blue flames, silently screaming, as my mage blade quivered in my fist. There weren't any goblins here that I could see. That just left Uruk. He was near the arrow slit of the tower, facing the others. The boy was lit with an insane glow that crackled the air around him, so potent were the forces he had unleashed. He had a maniacal expression on his face, a leer of insane satisfaction that I had last seen on the mad mage of Faris while he was hurling bolts of death at my squad. Uruk was taller. He had levitated himself about 4 feet off the ground, and had 4 witchstones whirling around his head above his brow, adding to the angry green glow on his face. I stopped dead in the doorway for a second and just stared at the scene.
Ah, oh, Master Minolan,
the boy said with relish, his grin broadening in an unpleasant manner.
How nice of you to join us. I was just telling Master Garkescu and Senior Apprentice Fenar how shitty it was being a junior apprentice.
He glanced at the burning figure of Fenar.
Let's see. I just finished talking about how educational it was doing all of their fucking laundry. I guess I can talk about how fulfilling it was getting beat up and teased all of the time just 'cause I am youngest. I guess the bloody shoe is on the other bloody foot now, isn't it?
He laughed giddily as Fenar writhed in agony. Still no screams came out of his mouth, but it wasn't for lack of trying. The flames burned at his flesh,
making it smoke and blacken.
"Ulrich, don't!"
I yelled, as Tyndall slipped into the room behind me, taking in the situation. He held his sword down at his side, doing his best to conceal it. He had a wand in the other hand. Smart boy. But Ulrich wasn't watching him. He was focused on me and my blade.
"Fuck you, Master Mage! You thought you were so God's damned superior to us. All you had that we didn't was the witch stones. And I've got four of the things now. Do you know how long I've waited for this chance? I waited until they were all asleep before I took them. I always knew I was better than all of them, and they hated me for it. I was better than Fenar, I was better than Rundal, I was better than our vaunted master, and I was even better than you. And you all hated me for it."
"No one hates you, Ulrich. We know how good you are, but you don't know everything you need to yet," I said soothingly. I was struggling to find a spell that might calm the situation, but nothing was springing to mind. The boy clearly did have talent, perhaps more than I'd realized. I'd had a hard enough time wielding the power of two stones, and he had four of them now.
"No one hates me?"
he scoffed in disbelief at me, his eyes full of rage.
"Then why did they make me do all of the shipwork around the lab? Why did they make me do dishes and sweep night after night? Why did they call me names? Why did they yell at me and beat me up? Why did our master call me stupid and useless when he couldn't wipe his own arse without our help? Why does Fenar bugger me every other night, Master Mage, huh?"
"Ulrich, just put the stones away," I urged, blanching at the revelation. "We can talk about all of this, but not until..."
"I don't need to talk anymore. I told Garki, and he didn't do anything about it. The senior apprentice's prerogative, he calls it. Says it's part of the price we pay for our magic. Why does Fenar do that, huh? Because he loves me?" "Oh, Ulrich,"
he said, in the mocking voice 12-year-old boys everywhere know instinctively, rolling his eyes and fluttering his eyelashes.
"I love you so much that I want to shove my..."
Tyndall chose this moment of distraction to fire a volley of magical bolts at the kid with his wand. The attack took Ulrich by surprise, but he easily blocked it with the sheer power of the stones. I rolled across the room and sent another bolt at him from Slasher's arcane arsenal, summoned on the spur of the moment, and knocked him back a ways. Ulrich recovered quickly, though, and it took every ounce of my power to keep from falling to the bolt he returned at me. The expression of magical power is a function of the mage's emotion. Put enough behind it, and it increases, particularly for war spells. Such rage, such emotion, filtered through the power of four stones, was daunting. It was like trying to stand up straight in a windstorm. I'm lucky he didn't blow a hole in my head. Thankfully, Tyndall didn't let up on his attack, searing the air with his just-learned magical strikes. The part of my mind that wasn't preoccupied with staying alive took a moment to appreciate the ease with which he summoned the spells and their apparent elegance, and I felt proud of my apprentice. He fought bravely and cleverly. Every bolt was different, in an attempt to foil the boy's defense, and a few did actually get through. I threw a couple of low-strength attacks at him myself while I thought furiously, mostly stunning and blinding spells I had hung on Slasher against future need. There was no way that Tyndall and I, even combined, could match the raw power of Ulrich's Irionite halo. Like the Gavani shamans we had faced, I realized in a split second, we would have to finesse an attack. Overpowering the overpowered apprentice was just not a possibility. Hell, it should have been easier than taking out a shaman, as Ulrich wasn't nearly as well trained. Garkescu was pretty stingy with passing on spellwork. The problem was the reckless way that the boy was drawing power from the stones, flinging it around without a thought to the consequences, and the random manner in which he fought. It was a wild assault on anything and everything, raw power driven by madness and anger, with little control. How do you fight a bolt of lightning? Twice I tried a frontal assault, and I'm lucky that I wasn't killed in the attempts. The first time he flung me back against the wall, just missing an arrow slit, where I slid to the wooden floor in a daze. I had to dodge a wildly writhing Fenar as I recovered while Ulrich dealt with Tyndall's latest attack. The second time put me flat on my back, staring up at Rundal floating lazily by. The frightened apprentice tried to say something to me,
but the roar of the fight between Tyndall and Urik made his words meaningless. I had to stop this now, I realized, or the boy would tear apart the tower itself. I prepared myself for a third direct attack when I saw what Randall had been excited about. The shields around Urik were solid, almost impenetrable. With the power he had at his disposal and the will born of adolescent rebellion, he had enveloped his body with a swirling globe of radiance, the thickest defenses I'd ever seen. I couldn't have blasted him with anything significant. But Randall had noticed that Urik hadn't thought to extend the protection to the actual stones that powered it. All four were orbiting above his head, outside of his robust defenses. Perhaps he thought that they would protect themselves. More likely, he had probably overlooked the weakness entirely, the sort of oversight any apprentice can make. That gave me a modicum of an idea. As potent as they were, the witchstones were still only pieces of amber, no harder or more resilient than any other rock. Indeed, much less so than most rocks. With them hovering outside of the defenses they powered, they were vulnerable. They could be attacked, even if Urik could not. Gathering myself up for the attempt, I nodded to my apprentice and indicated that he should keep the boy busy. Tyndall redoubled his flurry of assaults, sailing bolt after magical bolt at the glowing spherical shield around the boy while dodging the raw power Urik volleyed back at him. He wasn't entirely successful, but he kept moving. I took a deep breath and cast some war magic, the spell that increased my speed and my agility measurably, and could perhaps let me get away with the damn fool stunt I was planning. I waved my sword menacingly as a distraction and sprung at Urik, who was laughing madly at Tyndall's wild dance. The boy gave me a glance, a sneer, tossed a stray bolt in my direction, and returned his attention to my apprentice. I guess it was just more fun to beat up on an older kid than an adult. My enhanced reflexes allowed me to anticipate and deftly dodge the attack, while simultaneously dropping my blade to the floor. If I had tried to do this unenhanced, I probably would have disemboweled myself. I sped toward the defensive globe of the 12-year-old tyrant, my hands free. That last part is important, because instead of crashing into the boy, which would have been unlikely, if not impossible, considering the potency of his defenses, I crouched at the last second and vaulted over his head, the augmentations of the war magic allowing me to clear the top of the defensive globe by mere inches. I swung my legs up over my head, gave myself a little telekinetic push to ensure I'd make it, and in less than a second, I had two of the witchstones in my palms. They burnt my hands with the power that was flowing through them, but they came away from the boy's control as easy as pulling a nail out of wood. When I had landed behind him, I had shifted the balance of power in our favor. Urik's shield weakened considerably, and Tyndall's bolts were starting to have an effect. I had three stones in my possession now, and I knew I had to end this thing quickly. The duel was having a profound impact on the integrity of the tower around us. I didn't really think about it. I raised both stones, accessed the one around my neck, and with the combined might of all three, I unloosed a massive shock bolt directly at one of Urik's remaining stones. It shattered, or more accurately, pulverized into dust-like shards and smoke. In doing so, it released a thunderclap of pure magical power that overtook everyone in the room. Tyndall fell to the floor at the psychic shock, while I was knocked backward by the pure force of the response. Garkescu fell from his uncomfortable perch on the wall, and poor Randall plummeted a good 15 feet to the hard floor. He took it in the shoulder, which was painful, but spared him any more serious trauma. Fenar was perhaps the least affected, as he was already on the floor and already unconscious, his skin a mass of nasty red welts from the magical blue fire. I saw he was having a hard time breathing, and his limbs spasmed uncontrollably as the blue flame died around him, snuffed out by the wave of power. We were, for the moment, safe. Me? I lost consciousness. It seemed like the right thing to do. 10 minutes later I came to, cradled in Alia's lap and surrounded by Sao Kusi's confused men. Tyndall was still out cold, but Garkescu and Randall were awake, if shaken. Fenar looked like someone had run him over with a wagon and a team of 4 wild horses, and then backed up. Alia held a cup to my lips and I tasted wine, coughed, and tasted it again. There was a little blood from my lip mixed with it.
"Take it slow, love,"
Alia cooed, worriedly.
"Just go slowly."
Tyndall awoke soon after Sir Kay helped me to my unsteady feet, my hand stung from the raw power of the stones that had passed through them. We all finally gathered around little Uruk's body. It was a mess. His head was charred into an unrecognizable mass by the arcane blast, leaving only his blankly staring eyes to show that it once had been a face. All trace of boyishness was gone. He was a corpse, a dead man, whose features had been aged by magic and flame. The air was filled with the aroma of ozone and cooked flesh, and something else. I didn't think about it at the time, but the smell would eventually come back to haunt me later in life. In those nightmares you don't want to mention, lest they come true. Sir Kusi wanted answers, of course, and between Garkescu and myself we tried to inform him about what exactly went wrong. He tried to be understanding, but it was obvious that the duel had deflated his hopes that a creative magical core would overcome the vast army that besieged us. With Uruk dead and Fenar in the infirmary, unlikely to survive the night, our resources had been cut by almost a third. He started to demand someone take responsibility for the disturbance, but I politely stopped him. Recrimination.